All right, today we're going to talk about Ezra Nehemiah. Okay, there are Hall of Famers, this week's Hall of Famers. Now, Ezra and Nehemiah were the spiritual and political leaders that built the Second Commonwealth. But before we get to that, we need to begin with Koresh. Koresh was this Persian king that made a proclamation. He allows all the Jews living in the Persian Empire to return to Eretz Israel and build the Beit HaMikdash. Now, why? Why would he do such a thing? It's a little bit strange. So three different answers I came across. There might be more. And they don't necessarily contradict each other. All three might be correct. One is Yeshayahu had said in Nevuah 140 years earlier that there would be this king, even says Koresh, that would allow the Jews to go back. He might have read, he might have heard about it, he might have felt it was referring to him. And he decided to help the Jews, to tell them that it's now permissible for them to come back to Eretz Israel and build the Beit HaMikdash. Okay, one idea. Most historians have a different idea, and theirs is that the Persians were Zoroastrians, which meant that although there was a major god, there were lots of other gods, and it was permissible in their religion to believe in other gods, and therefore they felt it'll be easier for us to run our empire if we're tolerant, allow everyone to worship their own god. There'll be less rebellion because people will feel, okay, I'm not being oppressed. And therefore they said, every single person, even if they were displaced from their homes, can move back to their original place anywhere in the Persian Empire and build your temples. But most people, including the Jewish people, had already been displaced for so long that the generation had already been born foreign land that they said, well, this is our home. Why would we want to leave? Much the way you guys feel. Much the way you guys feel. Right? And therefore, since they were born there, they said, why would I want to go to Israel and build a Beit HaMikdash? I'm happy where I am. So most other nations and most Jews didn't take them up on this. Okay? This is a second idea. And a third idea, Rav Meidan suggests that his predecessor, at least his predecessor in Sefer Daniel, Belshazzar, the Babylonian king, he made a mistake. We're going to be learning Megillah after Pesach discusses this. Belshazzar felt that the Nevuah of Yirmiyahu, that there will be 70 years of Galus, then the Jews rebuild the Beit HaMikdash, was up. And the Jews didn't come back, so he celebrated. He had a big party, took out the Kelim of Beit HaMikdash, and then a very strange thing happened. A hand floated into the room and started to write on the wall. Right, when you guys hear the phrase, the handwriting on the wall, it's not the handwriting on the wall, it's the hand writing on the wall. And there was a hand, he sort of couldn't control himself, peed in his pants when he saw this, called in all the people to try to explain it, till Daniel, that's where it comes from, Daniel, very similar to Yosef, is able to interpret what happened, and he's given all these reward, even though the interpretation is, you're a dead man, he kept his word, and Belshazzar now is over. At this point, Koresh says, you know what? No need to antagonize the God of the Jews. Go out, go back, build your, take the Kelim, go to the Beit HaMikdash. Okay, so all three of these ideas, as I said, are not necessarily contradictory. And there might be more, but the fact is Koresh did do this. Right? Just as an aside, I remember when I was in BMT, there were these two guys of Persian descent, like we have here in our yeshiva, and their Persian father decided to name them Cyrus and Darius for the two good Persian kings, Koresh and Daryavish. I thought that was interesting. Anyway, this proclamation of Koresh is compared to the Balfour Declaration. Right? What year was the Balfour Declaration? 1917. Very good. We're almost coming up on the centennial. He was then the foreign minister, and he wrote a letter to Lord Rothschild, who was then the president of the British Zionist Federation, and there he stated the famous words, His Majesty's government, you know, et cetera, et cetera, views with favor the establishment in Palestine of a Jewish homeland for the Jewish people. Okay, great. It's uncanny, though, how similar it is. Balfour did it for idealistic reasons. He was embarrassed about the oppression of the Jewish people through the centuries by Christians. And therefore, and he was a Bible reader, and he felt the Jews should come back. He was actually more into this than some of the Zionist leaders. But he felt, you know, the Bible says they should come back, and he felt that he was an instrument in helping the Jews come back to their homeland. Before he died, he told his niece that of all the things he did in his life, and he actually had a term as the prime minister in England, he felt that this was the most praiseworthy achievement that he did in his life. But now, here's what's uncanny. The same way that when Koresh said, you can go, but the Jewish response was underwhelming, so too with the Balfour Declaration, you can go. And the Jewish response was underwhelming. And then, we'll see soon, Koresh rescinded his permission, and also, 2,500 years later, in 1939, the British government basically rescinds their permission, and they publish all of these white papers that basically cancels permission for the Jews to come, and so it's put quotas on how many Jews can enter Eretz Yisrael. So history has a way of repeating itself, yeah.
Wasn't it the Shomronim who were living in Eretz Yisrael living in Slav?
I'm going to get to that. Yes, very good. Now, other similarities between the Shivat Zion, the return to Zion, in Sefer Ezra and Nehemiah, and about a century ago, include, when they got there was different levels of religious observance. There were chilonim, there were datiim, there were different approaches, how to deal with them. Ezra cries in pain about how terrible it is, and Nehemiah starts making all sorts of religious legislation. Second difference, the path to the geula is laid with many obstacles. Lots of opposition from the local inhabitants, both then and more recently. Third similarity. Many people were disappointed with the religious conditions and said, this can't be the geula, or the etchalta of the geula, whatever you want to call it, because look how terrible the religious situation is. And fourth similarity, other Jews said, let's be thankful to HaKadosh Baruch Hu for what we have. Instead of looking at the glass half empty, let's look at it at half full and say, this is an amazing opportunity that we have. We're coming back to Eretz Yisrael after so long. Now, the leaders that came up with the Jews this first time, I'll call it the Aliyah, the first Aliyah, right? The leaders that came with the Jews were, I don't know if you've heard of the names, Sheshbatzar, anyone hear the name? Okay, Zerubbabel, okay, and Yoshua Kohen Gadol. How many Jews end up coming back? About 42,000. About 42,000 at the end of Gemara Kedushin, but 42,000, not necessarily from the greatest of the Jews. Most of the Jews that were there were comfortable, were happy, and they didn't come back. Right, the Gemara Kedushin, it makes sense also. Who are the people that leave when there's a pogrom? People who, right, don't have anything to lose. They've got no property, they've got no business. They said, all right, I'll try something new. So the 42,000 that came were not necessarily the elite of the community. They came with a few leaders. This is about 50 years after the Churban. Also in Eretz Yisrael at this time, you had the last three Nevi'im who also served in the Asher Knesset Gedola. Anyone know their names? Who are the last three Nevi'im? Chagai and Zechariah. Good. Chagai, Zechariah, and Malachi. Now, the permission from Koresh was only to build the Beit HaMikdash. But all the Jews who were coming knew that this was how an independent nation was going to get born. All right, we'll start with the Beit HaMikdash, and we're going to spread out. This was certainly the plan of everyone coming. Now, the local inhabitants at first, when they see this, they say, hey, can we help? We'd like to be a part of the building of your temple. And they are rebuffed by Zerubbabel. Why do you think that is? Why does he say thanks but no thanks? What? Okay, good. Maybe they felt that they would sabotage it, either physically or spiritually. Or maybe they just felt, hey, we're building the holiest building in the world. Why would we want to have foreign workers? We're going to have Avodah Ivrit. We're going to have Jews doing it. Shlomo did. It's a good question, right? So there's a question about that. So when they came back, they said, we're going to do it ourselves. So too, you know, we're talking about the first Aliyah of a century and a half ago, they also felt, we do everything on Avodah Ivrit. We're not going to use, today, I think it's terrible. You have these Jews who are unemployed. There are jobs open for what? Construction. But I don't want to do that. I'm a Jew. I don't do blue-collar labor. It's terrible. So I think when the third temple is going to be rebuilt, we're going to have Arabs build it. It's going to be a terrible thing. Jews should be building. That's what Zerubbabel felt. And he said no. Now, sometime later, the inhabitants, after being rebuffed, they slandered the Jews. They sent messages to the king of the Persian Empire and said, the Jews are trying to rebel against you. And with that, the permission was rescinded. Koresh himself takes away the permission to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash. Now after this, time goes by, Chagai, one of the Nevi'im, gives them Musar. Says, what, are you going to listen to that? So what if there's a law? Let's go and do it. Let's start building the Beit HaMikdash. And they start to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash. Locals complain. At this point now, there's a new king in charge. And the new king doesn't really know what's going on. So he says, let me look into it. And he goes through the archives. And miraculously, all he finds is the original proclamation of Koresh, giving the Jews permission. Doesn't find the letter that this permission was taken away. And he tells the local inhabitants, stop bothering them. You know, help them build it. This is the law of the land. Okay. Second base of Mikdash is rebuilt. What? Daryavish. Okay. Now, the first Aliyah, the people that came, they're enthusiastic. They're naive. They didn't anticipate all the difficulties that ensued. And with the work stoppage and subsequent Yeridah, there's small, well, not necessarily that. Oh, it depends. Okay. I'm not sure exactly which king. It's not so clear. Okay. There's two Daryavishes, and there's a lot of Persian kings in between. But at least one opinion says that. Yes.
Did the Purim take place
before or after? I'll get to Purim in a second. Okay? Because of their naivete and because of the difficulties, a lot of the Jews said, wow, this is not what I bargained for, and they left. So of the 42,000 that were there, not a lot, not all of them stayed. So now you have this small number of Jews living with local inhabitants, and they start to assimilate. And therefore, even when they have this Chanukat Habayit, a lot of the people that are there start to cry in sorrow. Some are crying with joy, and some are crying with sorrow, because there were even some people old enough to have remembered the first base of Mikdash, and said, wow, compared to that, this stinks. This is a shack. Okay? So, it depends. Now, the Purim story comes in between. Okay? And we'll get to, you know, it could be, I'll get to right in a second soon, you know, when Ezra comes around, but you should know that what's going on in Ezra and Nehemiah is the exact same time as going on in Persia. Okay, maybe sometime later, I have the shir on comparing the two, understanding the Purim story by understanding Ezra and Nehemiah, Bezrat Hashem, sometime later in the year. By the time Ezra comes, 80 years after the Koresh proclamation, he finds ignorant people, don't even speak Hebrew, and lots of intermarriage. Ezra gets permission from the new king to come and is given a letter that empowers him, not just economically, but judicially. He is given autonomy, punish people the way you want, set up whatever rules you want. You know, you're the boss. What's the reason behind this amazing letter? So once again, I came across a few different reasons. None of them are contradictory. They all might be true. You could say the personal charm of Ezra was able to win over the king. Okay. Second, could be politics, you know. And third, maybe Mordechai, who we know had been the advisor of the previous king, stayed on. We know a lot of times a prime minister or president takes over and keeps some of the advisors to be part of his, you know, cabinet and advisors, because they already know what's been going on beforehand, and keep this continuity. Possibly this new king kept Mordechai as an advisor. If Mordechai had this new king's ear, so it makes sense why he was so pro-Ezra, you know, having the permission to run the show the way he wanted to. Therefore, although smaller in size and just a few thousand, now only a few thousand come, it carried more weight. This I would call the second Aliyah. Okay, this is Ezra comes, a few thousand, but it has more political weight. When faced with the challenge of intermarriage, lots of couples had intermarried, he has a few options. Option number one is do some quickie conversion. Say, everybody, okay, let's go. We'll have a 3-day seminar, teach you the Torah, and we'll all go dunk in the mikvah, and everyone will be converted. Okay? That's a possibility. The only thing is it wouldn't necessarily solve the problem that the non-Jewish spouse is leading people astray. If it's an insincere conversion, so they'll be still be influencing their children and their spouses because they didn't really give up their religion. So that won't really solve so much of the problem. Option number 2, he has the power, legislate against it. Make it illegal, arrest people who intermarry, punish them, give them malchus, whatever it is. King gave you carte blanche, do whatever you want. But he chose not to go this route. And instead he went for what's behind door number 3, tried to persuade the people to change. Now we see that Ezra, he cries, he pulls out his hair, he declares fast days for the people to do tshuva, and we are told that 117 people got rid of their non-Jewish spouses. The only thing that we're not told is out of how many. Right? So was that 117 out of like 118? Well, wow, that's amazing. Was it 117 out of, 15,000? I tend to think it was closer to the second, because otherwise you probably would have said almost everybody, got rid of their spouses. No, it could still be a big deal. 117 people got rid of their non-Jewish spouses and their kids were brought up Jewish and who knows where descendants from them. You know, let's say you went in Fleshner to, Hollywood in California and told all the Jewish people, directors and film stars that are married to non-Jewish spouses, you got to get rid of them, and 3 people listen. We'd all probably say, wow, 3 people, that's pretty amazing. So it could be 170 people. That's really phenomenal. But like I said, out of how many, not clear at all. Ezra came to be the religious ideological leader. He's called Ezra Sofer. The Sofer means he's Talmud Chacham. He comes to educate, not legislate. And even though he had the backing of the Persian Empire, he didn't want to rule through Dina D'Machus Adina. Rather, he set up the Anshei Knesset Agdola and legislated through Torah. Even when he came, he felt that he's representing an Ish Emunah. The king says, listen, you're going now on a journey to Eretz Yisrael. This is a long and dangerous journey to go from the Persian Empire to get to Eretz Yisrael. The traveling took close to 4 months. He said, I'll give you an armed escort. And he didn't want to feel that he needed that, because he says, I believe in God. And he left without it. He left a couple of days before Pesach, very symbolic, leaving Gullus on his way to Eretz Yisrael. And he arrives on Rosh Chodesh Av. Right here it is, the month of Avelus. And he wants to turn Miyagon L'Simcha. Right? There's a joyous time. He brings 12 Karban Olas on so obviously representing all the Shvatim. And he sets up a platform and has a public reading of the Torah. Like what?
Like Hakel.
You cannot overestimate the impact that Ezra had on his generation and all future generations. The Gemara in Sukkah says that when the Torah was forgotten in Israel, Ezra came up from Babel and established it. The Gemara in Sanhedrin goes further and says, had Moshe Rabbeinu not received the Torah at Sinai, Ezra would have been worthy of receiving the Torah at Sinai. That's how amazing Ezra Sofer was. The importance of Ezra is that this became the transition period from Nevi'im as the leaders to Talmidei Chachamim as the leaders. It was no longer God's going to communicate through the Navi, but now it's anyone who's smart enough to understand and make drushes from the Pesukim, to understand what the Pesukim are telling me. While Kohuna is hereditary, while Malchus is hereditary, anyone could be a Talmud Chacham. Mishnah says, Mamzer Talmud Chacham gets more covered than an Amaretz Kohen Gadol. And now anyone can be a leader in Klal Yisrael. Okay? Just work hard enough and you can become a leader, a part of the transmission. He set up the Anshei Knesset Gadol, and together they made Takanot that changed Judaism till today. If we would have gone back pre-Ezra, we really wouldn't recognize Judaism. So many things that were instituted that we take it as daily things. So, for example, the Anshei Knesset Gadol fixed the daily prayers that we have. Not everyone spoke so well. So those who were more fluent, they just prayed beautifully, said all these beautiful praises, made their requests, thanked the Kadosh Baruch Hu. And other people said, rub-a-dub-dub, thanks for the grub, yay God. Right? And that was the extent of their tefillah. And Ezra now makes, with the Anshei Knesset Gadol, they write in Hebrew, and they laid the groundwork for the Siddur. Shemona Esrei is done by them. And Brachot, and Tfilot, and Kiddush, and Havdalah. If before God spoke to man, now we kept the line of communication open, man speaks to God. And the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, they're responsible for this. They decided what books make the cut, what's accepted into Tanakh. Right? We just look around, we go, oh, obviously that's Tanakh. That's not. They're the ones who made that decision. They changed the script back to Ktav Ashuri. Again, this is machlokas, but I'm just going to tell you one opinion, that the Torah was originally written in what we look at as we think a Hebrew script, but that was called Ktav Ashuri, not from the word like Assyrian, but Ashrei, like beautiful, happy, like this, whatever, this. Ktav Ashurit, but after we sinned with the Cheda Egel, we were no longer on the level to have it, and we had that. Now we've seen it like an archaeological stuff. That stuff looks like, you know, chicken writing, right? Yeah. So that called Ktav Ivri. And now, since there was no longer Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zarah, they went back and we have Ktav Ashuri. We have Ktav Ashuri. They changed this back. Moshe had been mitaking that we should lane three times a week, Monday, Thursday, Shabbos, but you only had to lane three psukim. Just to have some sort of religious experience. Ezra said, no, we need more than that. We need a chunk of reading so that we're learning something. That's a din in Talmud Torah. At least 10 psukim, so that I feel like I'm learning something. And since I want to understand it, since Talmud Torah, so you have a Meturgaman. Because, as we said, not everyone understood Hebrew. Right? We should have one today into English, because 90% of people in our shuls don't understand 90% of Kriyas Torah. So they had a Meturgaman. And Teimanim, some of the Teimanim till today in their shuls have a Meturgaman. That was important, so people understand. And he set up the Anshei Knesset that based in which meet every Monday and Thursday. So many things that we take for granted was set up by this Anshei Knesset HaGedolah. All right. Now we move to the third Aliyah, and the third Aliyah is Nehemiah. Okay, just so you should know, Ezra and Nehemiah, we call two books, and Tanakh is actually one book, but we're moving into Nehemiah. Nehemiah was the Sara Mashkin for the Persian king. So Sara Mashkin means what? The butler. Now, if you were pouring the king his wine, you were one of his most trusted officers, because the king trusted you with his life. It means Nehemiah was close to the king. And when he heard from some Jews who came and visited from Eretz Israel how the situation there was very, very difficult, okay, with the neighbors around them, walls being breached, all sorts of problems the Jews were having there in Eretz Israel. Even though there was a Beit HaMikdash, there was so many problems there in Eretz Israel, he made a plan. And 3 months later, he's pouring the king wine, and he was a very good actor. All of a sudden, like a tear starts rolling down his cheek. And the kings go, yo, Nehemiah, what's up with that? Oh, am I sorry? I'm sorry. It doesn't matter. No, tell me. You know, I just heard that my brethren in Eretz Israel, they're suffering, that they're desecrating cemeteries. They're burning down the walls. Now, this was an emotional plea. The Persians, they had a lot of respect for dead. You're desecrating cemeteries is a bad thing. And it says that the king and the queen. Now, some of the Persians say, the queen doesn't mean his wife, but it means the queen mother. And according to some of Farshim, who would be the queen mother? None other than Esther. Esther and her son, according to this opinion, give Nehemiah permission to go back and do whatever needs to be done. So now, 13 years after Ezra came to Eretz Israel, Nehemiah too arrives on Rosh Chodesh Av, and he immediately sets to work. He comes with less authority than Ezra did, but more political acumen. He understands that Jerusalem is the key. Even if the Beis HaMikdash is built, if the walls are still destroyed since the time of Nebuchadnezzar, no one feels safe there. You know, you're going to go there and maybe someone's going to attack. Certainly no one's living in the city there because it's dangerous. So he sets about to rebuild the walls. His entire personality is activism. He sets up each family. Start building the wall near where you live. Like the original Haganah. Defend where you're living. Build the wall. Build it up where you're living. They worked and they protect themselves from their neighbors. They work day and night. Day and night. Fight to protect your family. They worked round the clock, and in 52 days, the wall was completed. This, however, led to other problems. Since they were working nonstop, people stopped working for a living, and now they can no longer support their families. So those who were poor were borrowing from the rich. Now they had no money to pay back, and the wealthy people took their Jewish brethren as slaves. When Nehemiah heard this, he went berserk. He goes, I don't get it. What is wrong with you guys? If these Jewish brethren of ours would have been slaves for Goyim, we would spend every cent we have to redeem them, to get them back. And now you're taking them as slaves? So he led by example. He said, look, some of you wealthy people, I loaned you money to get your businesses started. So here's the deal. I'll cancel all the debts you owe me. I want you to cancel all the debts that are owed to you. And it became a Shemitah and Yovel altogether. They canceled debts, set the slaves free. And this is how Ezra not only breached the cracks in the wall, but the cracks in society. As opposed to Ezra, he does legislate to keep observance. While Ezra pulled out his hair in a state of despair over the intermarriage was still prevalent when Nehemiah gets there. He hears about it, and he pulls out their hair and curses them. And he, you know, gives them punishments. He's also, he's Yirei Shemayim and he's Isha Munah, but he's not Somech on any Nisim. He asks for and receives from the king an armed escort when he comes. When in Israel, he sets up armed forces, repairs the wall, moves the people into Yerushalayim. He gives them not just tax breaks, but like a stipend. You know, he knows we need to have a strong capital city surrounding the Beit HaMikdash, and he encourages people to move into Yerushalayim. He writes a constitution about Shmiras HaMitzvos, basically to separate from the Goyim, to turn the Beit HaMikdash into the central role of daily life. People had been doing business on Shabbos. Okay, they said, I'm not doing any Doraisas. He closes the gates to commerce. He institutes all sorts of laws of Muktzah that didn't apply before him. He sets up the Mishmarot for the Kohanim, coming to the Beit HaMikdash once every 24 weeks. Karban Eitzim, people volunteering, being part of the Beit HaMikdash. And he generally works in harmony with Ezra. So to summarize, it's possible that Ezra, because of his takanot and the Anshei Knesset Gedolah, is more well known to us today. But it might be that it's only because of the leadership of Nehemiah was Ezra able to accomplish so much. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome.